Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all parties are on a listen-only mode. I would like to inform all parties this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Kenneth Frank. You may begin.
Thank you, Shelby. If you'd please open up the lines, and we'll find out who's listening out there and what club they're affiliated with before introducing our speaker this evening.
This kind of.
All lines are open at this time.
Hi, Ken. This is Joan Chamberlain from Astronomical Society of Northern New England in Maine.
Oh, my goodness, not in somewhere like Bangladesh or up in the Himalayas, huh?
Not right now.
Hi, this is Barb Dagle, Brooks Astronomy in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Hi.
Hi, this is Linda Prince at the Amateur Observer Society of New York on Long Island, New York.
Hi.
Ken, this is Art Zorka in Atlanta.
Hey, Art.
Love to see you.
This is Tom Dorsey from Watchtower Association of Celestial Observers in Ferndale, Washington.
Hi, Tom.
Ken, this is Theo Ramakas from the Charlie Elliott chapter of the Atlanta Astronomy Club.
All right, Charlie Elliott.
Cruz Pacheco from Central Florida, Astronomical Society in Orlando.
Florida.
Because of Bruce.
No. People are listening.
This is Jim Williams of the East Central Minnesota Astronomy Club.
Hey, Jim.
Peggy Walker from Broken Arrow Sidewalk Astronomers, Broken Arrow, Oklahoma.
What'd you say?
Peggy.
Oh, probably hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Alan Mowick from Morgan County Observatory. Berkeley Springs, West Virginia.
California, probably.
Great.
Paul Comer of San Jose Astronomical Association.
Ed Cedor with the Southwest Florida Astronomical Society in Fort Myers, Florida.
Hi,
hello, Ken. John Gallagher from the Hawaiian Astronomical Society, the land of paradise.
Aloha, John.
This is Roman Sill, Celestial Observers Guild in Skowhegan, Maine.
Hi.
This is Dan
Jim Head.
Charlie Elliott, Atlanta.
And I hear Jim Head in there, too. Hi, Jim.
This is Jim Hatch from the Starfield Observatory, Astronomical Society of Northern New England.
Hi, James.
Krishnadas Kosale from New Jersey Astronomical Association, New Jersey, obviously.
Hi.
All 50 states.
And I know that Art Zorka is out there, as well as Alice Deal. Anyone else there?
Roger Overcash from the Astronomical Society of Rowan County.
Hi.
Tom Cooney from the Starlight Astronomy Club in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Hi, Tom.
One of the members I know called in.
Okay, Shelby, I think that's about it. If
just not a good pally.
Close up the lines now.
Apparently not.
At this time, all lines will be on listen-only mode.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Night Sky Network's bimonthly 2011 series, teleconference, and we're pleased to have Dr. Ned Wright as our speaker this evening, telling us about the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, the WISE mission. We also have the pleasure of having Jessica Saniskoy, our Astronomy Outreach Project Coordinator, who will be listening in along with us this evening and monitoring Night Sky Info. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Ken. Hi, everyone. It's great to be with you again.
Got some plugs for us, Jessica?
I do. On October 1st, we recorded a podcast for everyone, and it'll be aired on 365 Days of Astronomy, and it's got the very provocative title of Look for the Bunny Girl, How NASA's Missions to the Moon Influence the Imagination. So we hope you'll listen in on October 1st, and we hope you're getting geared up for International Observe the Moon Night.
Which is October 8th.
That is October 8th. Yeah, we're going to do a kind of countdown on our Facebook page starting on October 1st. So we're going to do an 8-day countdown, and we hope to see you on Facebook. And if you're on Twitter, you can find us there. And if you're completely bewildered by Facebook or Twitter or both, you can always email me and we can have a nice chat about anything related to social media or anything techie.
And while you're at it, you can like the Night Sky Network and the ASP both, and we'll like your club. So Dr. Ned Wright of the University of California at Los Angeles is a principal investigator of the WISE mission. Ned grew up in Fairfax County, Virginia, on land once owned by George Washington. And Ned built a 6-inch Newtonian telescope while in high school and ground and polished the mirror himself. But without further ado to our telecon audience, please welcome Dr. Ned Wright.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, so we should start with the PowerPoint, and you should put it into slideshow mode because there are animated GIFs that should move, and then there's a separate movie that we'll look at for about half a minute in the middle here.
And I don't want to interrupt you, but just I wanted to let people know that that's on the download page. So just so if you, well, during the telecon, you can do that. Sorry to interrupt you there, Ned.
Okay, so let's get started and go to slide 2. And this is a little overview of the WISE mission. So it's a very small telescope. Some of you probably have bigger telescopes. So it's 40 centimeters in diameter. But it's kept cold by solid hydrogen. And that allowed it to be very sensitive in the infrared. So normally the atmosphere and telescopes emit a lot of infrared radiation because they're close to room temperature, and then that makes the detectors less sensitive because they're getting a lot of photons of noise. So we observed for a little more than 7 months and observed the whole sky. Then we kept going for a total of 13 months with a warm telescope that is warm. It's still colder than liquid nitrogen, and so we were still operating at 2 wavelengths. The other 2 wavelengths were being wiped out by thermal emission. So the next slide, slide 3, shows 3 pictures of myself. The first one on the left is an infrared, an optical picture, rather, and then about a minute later, the middle picture was taken in a near-infrared camera. And at some other time, the thermal infrared picture on the right was taken. And the thermal infrared, you see mainly temperature. So the in my eye sockets, there's less radiation and exposure to wind, so things are warmer there. And you can see around my neck where the shirt is keeping my skin warm that the temperature is highest. And that's where WISE is observing, in the thermal infrared. And this is what I illustrated, talked about before. On slide 4, the green curve is what you get from the ground. So that is a huge background of radiation. It's really foreground to what we want to see, but it's coming from the telescope in the atmosphere. And if you go into space, you get the red curve, and that is 2.7 million times less light at 10 microns. So it's as if the sky were 2.7 million times darker. And so that allows you to be much more sensitive. And so that's why WISE is so powerful, even though it's such a small telescope. And the way WISE works is to turn the telescope at a constant rate. So we're scanning at a constant inertial rate because that's what spacecraft can do rather well. And then within the telescope, there's a scan mirror that's in a sawtooth motion that freezes the image on the array for an 8.8-second exposure out of an 11-second cycle between frames. So every 11 seconds, we take a set of frames. And using dichroics, we take images simultaneously at 4 infrared bands. Okay, moving on to the next slide, you can see our scan pattern. We scan from the ecliptic pole down to the other ecliptic pole, and then we keep repeating this. So what we do is we always scan more or less perpendicular to the Earth's sun line. And then as the Earth goes around the sun, our scan circle moves around the sky. And after 6 months, because we're observing on both sides of this circle, we've covered the whole sky. We don't need a full year. We just need 6 months to cover the whole sky. And the way this works is we get an awful lot of overlap from orbit to orbit. So we are able, using this observations taken an hour and a half or 3 hours apart, to actually separate the asteroids from moving stars. And this is very important for what I'll be talking about. So going on to the next slide, slide 7, this is the computer's rendering of WISE in operation in space. So we had a fixed solar panel that's shown here in blue. Down at the bottom of the slide, there's a star tracker that's looking about 45 degrees off the main telescope axis. On the behind the telescope, there's another star tracker. So we have two star trackers figuring out where we're pointing. The green circular thing at the bottom is a high-gain antenna that we would point at the tracking and data relay satellite system and then transmit data to the ground. And we did that about four times per day. And so the telescope is sitting inside, you know, the black baffled area. And the white cylinder it sits inside is where is for keeping the telescope cold. It's the solid hydrogen cryostat. And slide 8 shows a blown up, or, you know, expanded view of that. So the thing in the middle is the cryostat. You can see a cross-sectional view through the big hydrogen tank sort of in the middle of that, and then a small hydrogen tank over to the right. And these are filled with solid hydrogen and keep the telescope cold. The telescope is over on the left in this expanded view, but it slides into the cryostat. This was all built by Space Dynamics Laboratory at Utah State University. And it's a very interesting technique. You need to, with solid hydrogen, you don't have any good thermal contact. It would just shrink and move away from the walls. So in order to maintain thermal contact, you have to have a metal matrix. And we used an aluminum foam. And so the way we actually filled the tank with aluminum foam is we took the aluminum foam and machined it to the right shape and then welded the top and bottom of the tank on around the aluminum foam because it's not at all flexible, so we had to do that. Now, this foam is 98.5% air and only 1.5% of aluminum, so it's a very low-density foam, but it provides thermal conduction, so the heat from the telescopes absorbed in the solid hydrogen. And here's an optical diagram. I don't think you'd want to build this telescope yourself. It has 13 mirrors. I showed a simple Cassegrain with the scanning secondary, but we actually have the scan mirror is mirror number 7 out of these 13 mirrors. And the reason for doing that is because we need very low distortion so we can get the same cancellation of motion over the whole field of view, and we have a fairly large field of view. So the next slide shows how we focus the telescope. This is what we call the blue tube test because there's this long liquid nitrogen-cooled blue tube in front of the cryostat. And then we sent parallel light in produced by the collimator and fold mirror that are outside in the warm laboratory, and then we had to make sure this fused silica window was very flat. That was a challenge, and then we made sure the cameras were focused, and so we focused on the ground. That seemed to work, so we were in good focus even after launch. After these tests in Logan, Utah, the spacecraft was being built in Boulder, Colorado. And so everything came together in Boulder, Colorado, and now you can see the spacecraft and the telescope together on the left. And then in the on the right, you see what's called the acoustic test. And if you look down at the right-hand picture, but on the lower left, you can see a guy walking by. And these are huge banks of amplifiers and speakers, as you might have for a stadium rock show. And they're all pointed in at little old WISE, which is sitting inside the protective tent there. because the sound from a rocket going up is incredibly loud, and we need to make sure that that doesn't vibrate anything and cause a failure. So after the acoustic test, that was the last testing, then we went out to Vandenberg Air Force Base. And I just wanted to show this picture of Wise sitting in the fairing of the Delta II rocket. Now, this is the smallest Delta II rocket. And pretty much United Launch Alliance, which builds the Delta II, wants to stop making them because there's not really enough business. And they want to continue building bigger rockets, Delta IVs and Atlas Vs. And you'll notice that Wise is tiny compared to the size of the fairing. And in terms of mass, this Delta II rocket could have launched a little more than 2.5 times the mass of WISE. So what's the smallest rocket, and soon to be an obsolete smallest rocket, is quite a bit larger than what we needed. So there's a real need for a, you know, better access to space with smaller and more flexible rockets, and cheaper, of course, cheaper. Now, once we were up on the top of the rocket, we needed to cool the solid hydrogen, and we needed to do that with liquid helium. And so we needed to take liquid helium doers, and these are 500-liter liquid helium doers. And you can see the liquid helium doer going up on a crane with some guy wires to keep it from swinging around too much in the wind, and then goes inside the launch tower, the mobile service tower, and goes up the last level inside. And so we were doing that, two of those liquid helium doers per day from November 20th to December 14th, 2009. And then finally we were able to launch. You know, we had a number of delays due to weather, but, you know, we got off really on our first attempt when weather actually looked possible. And it was somewhat marginal. You'll notice a bunch of clouds, but rockets don't mind clouds. They do mind rain, but it wasn't raining, so off we went. So took off from Vandenberg in California and then curved to the south over the Pacific Ocean. And this is an infrared picture. We have to have a thermal infrared picture of the launch, so off it goes. The rocket's exhaust is very hot, so it's glowing in the infrared. But one thing that's fun to do if you're close to a launch site is actually get out and see the rocket fly by. This was from Tujunga, which is about 200 kilometers away. It's near JPL. And so this shows the second stage burning and producing a plume. By this time, the rocket, we launched just before dawn. Now the rocket's up in sunlight. The sky is still dark. And so you get a very nice illuminated trail. So I mentioned that we take slides every 11 seconds, and the there's a little overlap from frame to frame. So each row in this picture on slide 18 is 11 seconds worth of WISE data. And so we get more than 7,000 rows like this every day. And what we have from left to right is 3.4 microns. That's about 7 times visible light, 4.6 microns, then 12 microns, 22 microns, and then there's a color composite that's formed from the 3.4, 4.6, and 12 micron channels. So that's fun to look at. You can see that dust clouds in the Milky Way show up very well at 12 and 22 microns. They also show up a little bit at the shorter wavelengths, but stars show up very well at the shorter wavelengths. So this is a very typical set of data. Now, if you look at the 3.4 micron image over on the left in the row labeled 162, this is the 162nd set of, you know, frame in a scan from ecliptic pole to ecliptic pole, you can see that there's a star in the middle towards the bottom. And if you look carefully, you can see that same star appears at the top in row 163. And that's the overlap from frame to frame. And so that small overlap from frame to frame allows us to make a continuous string around the sky. And then when we come back to the next orbit, we've shifted over a small fraction of the field of view, so then we get a lot of overlap. And so for any real source on the sky, it has to show up multiple times in the same position. But asteroids show up multiple times in different positions each time we look at them. So we have to look for those. Now this slide 19 is a little movie that's showing four consecutive orbits. So the same part of the sky, this is a small fraction of the field of view. So in this little crude movie, you can see a number of interesting facts. One is asteroids are red. They show up very well at 12 microns. They're conveniently circled by in green, so you can spot them. And you can also see that there's, you know, a fair number of sort of random things flickering on and off. And that's why we need to have multiple images to make sure we have a real source. But it's interesting to note that there's really only one fixed red star, or red, it's probably a galaxy, in this field. And most of the red objects are, in fact, asteroids. So that's fairly common. We saw a lot of asteroids. Okay, so at this time, I think it's probably a good idea to show a little bit of the movie. So we should drop out of slideshow mode and try running the movie. Okay, that's the Wise XY movie. And so if you have QuickTime or something equivalent available, then it'll play. We're not going to play the whole thing. This will wrap around. But what's happening here is in black, you're seeing the main belt asteroids that Wise observed. And in green, you're seeing near-Earth objects that Wise observed. And in red, you're seeing near-Earth objects that Wise discovered. And then in yellow, you're seeing comets that Wise discovered. And in blue, you're seeing other comets that Wise observed. So that should be about enough of it. It stops a little early here, and then so we can go back to the PowerPoint. And so I'm going to go back to the PowerPoint, and I'm now looking at a slide that I made that shows two seeing limited disks about one arc second across, and these are two different asteroids. Okay, and then if we go to the next slide, shows what would happen if you had a perfect telescope that could resolve milliarc seconds very well. And you can see that one of these asteroids is pretty large in diameter, but kind of dark, doesn't reflect very much. And the other one is small and reflects well, so it's much higher surface brightness. But if we go into the infrared on the next slide, we now have two orange disks, again with a perfect telescope that can resolve milliarc seconds. And you'll now notice that the higher surface brightness goes with the dark color. Dark things get hotter in sunlight than light things. And so we now have a higher surface brightness and a bigger diameter. So when we go into the infrared, now with a 6 arc second disk, which is about the angular resolution of Wise, you'll notice that the big dark asteroid is bright, and the small light asteroid is faint. So WISE is much more of a diameter-limited survey than any optical survey for asteroids. And this is an important enough point that, you know, people have been getting the Public Affairs Office to draw spiffy diagrams. Here's the next slide showing high albedo is chalk. So that's highly reflective and small, and low albedo is charcoal, and so that's much bigger, and they're equally bright in the visible light, but in the infrared light, obviously the large charcoal object is much brighter for WISE. And then there's a similar comparison now with equal-sized objects. They're all about the same brightness in the infrared, but the visible light surveys are much more likely to pick up the high albedo object. And then as a final illustration of this point, because this is the most important point I'm making all night, this is three models. These are the same size object, all at, you know, with different albedos. So one is 4% reflective, one is 14.5% reflective, and the green one is 52% reflective. And you can see that there's a range of optical brightness that covers more than a factor of 10 in brightness. So that's about 3 magnitudes difference between the black curve and the green curve. Whereas in the infrared, they're all roughly similar. But if anything, WISE is more sensitive to the black objects. So WISE is an excellent way to check to see whether previous asteroid surveys have missed a large number of dark objects. But with the thermal infrared, we can actually measure some other interesting properties of asteroids. That is, ones that we see multiple times. And by multiple times, I don't mean several times an hour and a half apart. I mean for an object whose orbit is such that it goes through our scan circle once, gets out, comes back maybe a month later, and goes through again, and then might come back several months later. And that was the case for the first near-Earth object that WISE discovered. That's 2010 AB78. And that's on slide 27. And you can see that with the image on the right. It's the only red dot in the frame, really. It's right in the middle. And the image on the left shows the path of WISE relative to the sun in the sky. So it's the ecliptic longitude relative to the sun and the ecliptic latitude. And the green bands are where WISE was scanning. So we picked it up in January, and then it went out of our field of view, and then it came back in February, and then it came back again in July. So I want to fit this with a thermal model for asteroids. And on slide 28, you should see a little cogwheel turning around. So this is a sort of schematic illustration of the kind of surface that I'm using. So I am using a spherical object, but it has craters in it. So the idea is to make something that's a little bit like a retroreflector, because there's a very strong beaming effect, not so strong in the infrared, but certainly strong in the optical. It's very obvious when you're looking at the moon. The full moon is much brighter than even the moon 2 days before full or 2 days after full. So when you're looking straight, you know, at an object, you're looking pretty much at specular solar reflection. You get a pretty bright thing. So the craters are designed to make like a corner cube reflector and do something like that. Okay, so what I've done is calculated the temperature of a whole bunch of facets in each crater. This is on slide 29. There's a little animated thing showing the temperature in a crater. And so the latitude of this crater is 19 degrees on the asteroid, and the sun's latitude is 30 degrees. So you can see the sun rises in the northeast, so the southwest heats up, and then it sets in the northwest. So then the last thing to be illuminated is over in the southeast. And then we can do on slide 30, this is just showing all the craters that I actually calculated. I didn't calculate an infinite number of them. So I did a grid of 16 different latitudes and 32 different longitudes. And this is showing all the temperatures. So it's about 65,000 temperatures that are calculated in this model. So it's a pretty good deal. You can see in this case with the sun at 30 degrees latitude, the South Pole, or close to the South Pole at the bottom, doesn't get any sunlight, so it's black. But what this model does, of course, is now you get some infrared radiation from the night side. You get most of it from the day side, but some from the night side. And if we go, well, let's stay on slide 30. If you look carefully, well, you sort of have to count the rows. You can actually see that the hottest time on the asteroid is not when the sun is directly overhead, but about an hour or so later, an hour. Well, the asteroid's rotation period isn't an hour, but what I mean is 15 degrees in the rotation of the asteroid. So it's like when you go outside, you know, it's not hottest at noon, it's hottest at 1 p.m., or in daylight savings time, that's 2 p.m. So that's our common experience. But what that means is that by looking at, now on slide 31, by looking at the observations that were made at different angles, we can actually try to find out which side is the morning side of the asteroid and which side is the afternoon side of the asteroid. And since we have three different observation times, we can do that. And so what I'm showing here is a plot of the goodness of fit of a model versus where the rotation pole is. So we can actually figure out where the rotation pole of this asteroid is, even though we've never looked at it with a telescope good enough to actually resolve surface features. And so that makes an interesting application of the infrared observations to studying asteroids. Another thing we can do with this data is actually figure out how good the surface is as an insulator. You know, if it's very well insulated, then the sunlight that hits the surface instantaneously heats the surface and there's no lag. But if it's a good conductor of heat, then the heat is conducted down into the asteroid and comes out later, and so there's a big lag in when the highest temperature is. So we can figure out the thermal properties of the surface. And so that lets us figure out what we see on slide 32. So the diameter of this asteroid is 1.3 kilometers. And it was anomalously faint when we looked at it in July. And that gives us a pole position that's accurate to about 25 degrees. It's not a very precise measurement of angle. But the obliquity of the pole appears to be 90 degrees relative to the orbit of the asteroid. So it's like Uranus. It's rotating around sideways to its orbit. The bond albedo, the fraction of the light that's reflected, averaged over all directions, is only 2%. And so that means this is a fairly large near-Earth object. You know, people had said that they'd discovered all of the near-Earth objects bigger than 1 kilometer. Well, not all, 90%. So it was a little bit disturbing to find that the first one that WISE picked up was bigger than 1 kilometer. But it's explainable by the fact it's quite dark. And so we were actually able to figure out the albedo, the size, and then also this thermal inertia parameter that's at the bottom row. This is kappa is the thermal conductance of the surface, rho is the density, C is the heat capacity of the surface. That combination of parameters is measurable, and it comes out to be 220 joules per Kelvin per meter squared per square root second. Weird units, I know. But it's actually something that you can measure. The moon has a much smaller value. Bare rock is about 2,500 in those units. So the moon is covered by a thick layer of dust, very good insulator. And bare rock has no dust, so this looks like the asteroid may have a thin layer of dust. Going on to slide 33, this is a table that you can find at the Minor Planet Center website. And for the year 2010, you see observatory code C51 is at the top of the list. And it sent in 3.75 million observations. That's WISE. And then the next highest or most prolific observer of asteroids in the year 2010 was one of the Catalina survey telescopes that sent in 1 million observations. So WISE was a very prolific observer of asteroids while I was working. And I just want to give you some reassurance, you know, the possibility that there could be a huge population of dark asteroids would have meant the hazard from asteroid collisions was higher than people had estimated. And so WISE did find dark asteroids, and this is a model that we fit to the WISE observations. And, you know, there's some dark asteroids, but only 29% of the ones we saw were dark. So it's not a huge uptick in the number of asteroids. And some of those dark ones were already found by optical surveys, so it's not like there's 29% uptick. It's even less than that. So that's good news. We don't have to, you know, panic about asteroid collisions, but it would be a good idea to keep looking. We especially want to find the 100-meter on up, from 100-meter to 1,000 meters, which could really wreck a city but aren't going to wipe out civilization. Those are fairly undiscovered yet. But we found some nice weird objects, too, and this is 2010 SO16 on slide 35. So this is a fairly large object, and it's in a horseshoe resonance with Earth. So that this is a coordinate system in the diagram. The coordinate system in the diagram is co-rotating with Earth. So it's rotating around once per year, so Earth is always in the same place. And the little light blue curve shows the asteroid's path in this co-rotating system. So it starts off at A, and it's in an orbit that's smaller than the Earth's orbit, so it's going faster than the Earth, catches up to the Earth, gets tugged by the Earth gravitationally, and then transfers into a larger orbit from B to C. And then it's in the larger orbit, and then it falls behind the Earth until it reaches D, where it comes back, and now it's getting pulled backwards by the Earth, and that transfers it back into the smaller orbit at E. And it takes 350 years for this asteroid to go around that circuit. And apparently it's stable in this resonance for a good fraction of a million years, maybe longer. And then this shows diagrams from the paper that was published about this. So you can see the same thing, but I should point out that the separation between the inner orbit and the outer orbit is exaggerated by 20x in this figure. So they're really very similar to each other. Then another object we found was 20K TK7, and Martin Connors up in Canada followed this up with the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, and so they got data and showed that it's actually a Trojan asteroid of the Earth. So it's in a big libration around the L4 point, the Lagrange point 4. And it's such a big libration that occasionally it gets to where WISE can see it. It's got to be 90 degrees away from the sun for WISE to see it. Whereas the L4 point, if it wasn't librating, is always 60 degrees away from the sun. So that's cool. And then, of course, we can see comets. So this is a very early picture we took before we started surveying in slide 38. Slide 38 shows the globular cluster M3 and comet Garrod. So comets are red because they're radiating thermal infrared radiation, whereas the red giants in the globular cluster are blue for WISE because they're quite hot, about 3,000 Kelvin. That radiates red light. And so it looks very blue when we're looking in the infrared. Okay, so this is on slide 39, there's a montage of all the 20 comet WISEs. So we just had another asteroid discovery from WISE show activity, so that would be a 21st comet WISE. So you see these are all pretty small. We didn't find any huge bright comets, but a lot of comets, so 21 comets, pretty good deal. Overall, we saw close to 100 comets. But, of course, we really built WISE to observe things that are fixed on the sky. And so if we go to the next slide, now you're looking at galaxies. So here's a montage of six nearby spiral galaxies. Now, these have all been hyper-resolved. We've used image sharpening to get a little higher angular resolution, and that makes the funny little box around the bright stars with the diffraction spikes. And then the next slide shows more galaxies, so now you can see EDGE-ON NGC 5907. And 6802 is kind of an irregular. In that field, we actually came back and observed it again 6 months later, and we can see a bunch of Cepheids that are brighter or fainter in the two different phases. And then in February of 2010, we sent out early release observations. So these were released on 16 February 2010. On the left, you see comet sighting spring. And on the right, you see NGC 3603, which is a star-forming region in our Milky Way. It's in the southern Milky Way. Next slide shows a familiar galaxy to most of you, the Andromeda Nebula, or M31, on the left. This is a 5-degree by 5-degree mosaic. And the image, which you can download if you go to the WISE webpage, is 6,666 pixels on a side. And then on the right, you have the Fornax cluster of galaxies, almost all elliptical galaxies, which are blue and fuzzy, but one spiral, NGC 1365. And then here's a planetary nebula. This is NGC 1514. Historically, this was the first planetary nebula that Herschel recognized as being something interesting. So he discovered planetary nebulae, and this is the first one. But it's got some weird rings around it. You can see that on the right where we have the WISE image. On the left, you have an optical image. So it looks like it's got two conical cones of dust coming out that are impacting something. So we get two rings, kind of a tilted configuration there. So there's lots of beautiful things in the WISE images. And just to get back to the asteroids again, this is IC410, a star-forming region in the Milky Way. But this is, the stack is made without removing outliers, so you actually see a couple of trails of asteroids that have been blown up. So you see the green dots in this particular composite. The red is 22 microns, and the green is 12 microns. Asteroids show up in both, so they're kind of greenish-yellow. You can also see some things in ellipses. So those are Earth satellites. Earth satellites are also at about room temperature and emit a lot of 12 microns and 22 microns. These are both high Earth objects, high Earth orbit objects, because they don't go all the way through the frame. And then there's a supernova remnant in the Milky Way. It's the Tycho supernova remnant. That's the red circle. And then there's a bunch of star formation going on nearby. And then I'll just like to point out some objects I've observed in the past. So Thor's Helmet, or NGC 2359, is a bubble that's around a Wolf-Rayet star that's blowing out a huge stellar wind. And I did a study of this in the optical back in 1979, and that was actually written up in Sky and Telescope in 1980. And then next slide is Bloom-Born Far Infrared Astronomy, and it shows me standing on the telescope that I did my thesis with, which was a far infrared telescope that flew in a balloon. And we mapped two very bright H2 regions, Orion and W3. And so there's the map of W3 that we made on the right. And then the next slide shows that figure from my thesis overlaid on a WISE image of W3, W4, and W5. And so you can see that the contours of far infrared emission do line up with the image of mid-infrared emission coming from WISE, but WISE, having 4 million pixels, did a lot better than the far infrared telescope with only 4 pixels. So the next slide shows M81 And M82 is the orange thing that's very much burnt out in the center. It's the brightest infrared galaxy in the sky because it's so nearby. And it's also very actively forming stars. M81 is a very nice spiral. And the green stuff around there is actually what are called cirrus dust clouds in the Milky Way. They're all over the sky. And this is a bright blue star, Zeta Ophiuchus. It's a runaway star. It used to be orbiting around another star that blew up in a supernova and cast it off at a high speed through the interstellar medium. And you can actually see a bow shock in front of it as it's plowing through the interstellar dust. Then finally, we ran out of hydrogen. So in the early part of August 2010, the big outer tank ran out of hydrogen, and then the telescope warmed up on slide 52. And you can see the telescope warmed up to about 45 degrees. That was still cold, Kelvin, absolute degrees. So that's still cold enough to observe at 12 microns, but not 22 microns. And then after, you know, really October 1st, we had no hydrogen left at all. So the long wavelength detectors stopped working. But we continued to observe at 3.4 microns and 4.6 microns. The telescope warmed up to 74 Kelvin. And then we're still working fine on when we transmitted the last data, which was February 1st, 2011. So this is the last light image from WISE. And now we should be on slide 54, getting close to the end here. So WISE has discovered many new near-Earth objects, and it's gotten data that allow us to calculate diameters for nearly 160,000 objects. So we've been looking for brown dwarf stars, and we found some. We've even found stars with temperatures down to room temperature. You may have seen a press release on that. And then we've surveyed star formation in the Milky Way and in massive ultraluminous infrared galaxies. The M82 is just a luminous infrared galaxy. It's not even to that level, but it's a pretty luminous infrared galaxy. And so now we're working on analyzing the data. So we actually have 10 trillion pixels worth of data. It's all down to the ground. So we're working on processing this. And so we did a preliminary release of the sky, which you can look at. You can go to the IPAC website and get images and catalog information. And if you want to see these pretty pictures and download them to your computer, or more pretty pictures, you can go to the website wise.astro.ucla.edu and click on Multimedia Gallery, and you can actually find all sorts of interesting results, press release material, and more movies showing the asteroid survey in process. So there's lots of interesting information there. So I think that's the last slide. Yep. So now we should open it up for questions.
That's great. Okay, Shelby, if you'd open up the lines for questions one at a time. Please.
Certainly. If you'd like to ask a question over the phone lines, please use star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Again, to ask questions over the phone lines, star 1. One moment, please, for the first question.
And while we're waiting for the first question, make sure that you log your events by the 30th of this month to qualify for the quarterly drawing and, of course, your toolkits. And on to the questions.
Our first question comes from Jim Wessel. Your line is open.
Hey, Dr. White. Thank you for the presentation. It's very good. Got a question. How does WISE compare to SOFIA for infrared astronomy? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. SOFIA is a big telescope, so it gets better angular resolution. But SOFIA is operating in the Earth's atmosphere, so it's up in the stratosphere, which is somewhat cold. But SOFIA is running at about 230 Kelvin. So that means that SOFIA is not as sensitive as WISE. It can point at objects for a long period of time, but, you know, basically SOFIA is designed for detailed study of brighter objects, and WISE is designed for an all-sky survey of fainter objects. So if you want to get an infrared spectrum. You can't use WISE. We didn't have a spectrograph, but SOFIA does have a spectrograph. But you need to have a brighter object to do that.
Our next question comes from Stuart Myers. Your line is open.
Oh, hello. Well, that was an interesting presentation. It was very impressive, some of the stuff that WISE has done so far. But my question is, one of the things that when they started up, when the mission was first put forth in that, they said it might detect objects extremely close to the solar system. But I haven't heard any reports of that. And I figure since you're closer to the project than I am by a considerable amount, I was wondering if you had heard anything, whether or not they were able to find anything very close to the solar system. And I mean, when I say close, I mean, you know, not like, say, 20 or 30, I mean, but fairly close in. I mean, you know, like amongst the nearest star level, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. The basic problem is when you look at a star, you don't know how far away it is. So we have a list of candidate objects that are pretty cold, the so-called brown dwarfs. And we have been working on this list, and what we need to do is observe them again. And we can do that with the Spitzer Space Telescope, which, even though it's warmed up, still is quite sensitive at the bands for which WISE picks up the brown dwarfs. And so with the Spitzer observations and the WISE observations, then we can try to find objects that look like they're very close to the sun. And so far we haven't found anything that looks like it's closer than about 10 light years, but we're working on it. And the problem is the ones that will be really close to the sun are the ones that are very cold. And then when we try to look at them with a ground-based telescope, we won't see anything. And then there's a certain disinclination to following these up because we might think that Spitzer won't see anything. But it is definitely something that we need to keep working at. And so what we're doing is trying to accumulate further observations of all these objects that WISE has discovered. And if we have the color selection right, we'll be able to tell. But, you know, it takes time to measure proper motions and parallaxes, and that's basically what we need to do.
Oh. Well, as I said, very thanks for the answer. Nice presentation, and I wish you the best of luck with whatever project you're going to be involved with next.
Our next question comes from Linda Prince. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Wright. I had a couple of questions about the slides. Slide number 25, you have the three objects ranging from very bright to very low albedo, the same size, and then as invisible light, and then in infrared light, they appear about the same. Why is it that the dark one is not brighter, theoretically being warmer? I was wondering. I didn't understand the
concept. Well, this slide is prepared by the Public Affairs Office, whereas my slides were prepared by really calculating the surface brightness. So the point of this is to show that you get pretty much the same infrared radiation for different albedos. And that's true until you get to things that are really bright, like chalk, where they're reflecting a fair fraction of the amount of sunlight. But really what we're talking about is objects that are low albedo is much darker than coal, say 2% reflectivity, and then the bright ones are 20% reflectivity. So there's not that big a difference in the amount of heating. There's some, but not that big. Whereas with chalk, really with chalk, it would be a good bit cooler.
So it's really the size of the object that causes more heating rather than...
No, it's the size...
Color.
The bigger. I mean, it's the same... Heating per unit area is what makes it hot. But, you know, by just having a bigger object, you intercept more sunlight, so you have more infrared radiation to produce. So that's what we're more sensitive to, is size than to reflectivity.
Okay, and in slide 45, the one that with the asteroid passing through in front of the
IC-410?
The nebula?
Yeah.
The asteroids look like they're a series of dots. Is that because they're spinning, or is that different exposures?
Different exposures. As I mentioned, we get multiple exposures of every point on the sky, and in this case, they've all been stacked up not to follow the asteroid, but to keep the stars fixed.
So it's not continuous?
It's not continuous. We don't see a continuous trail. We just see multiple images at different positions and different times.
Thank you very much.
No further questions at this time.
Okay, that was fabulous. I know I've got lots of questions, but I'll hold them off for now. Actually, I would like to ask, on slide number 35, the horseshoe orbit object, I've never encountered something like that. Is that a common occurrence in planetary objects with either Trojans or asteroids following orbits like the Earth?
I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not unheard of.
Hmm.
So I think there's a few, maybe a handful, of objects in horseshoe resonances with the Earth. And 2010 SO16 is the biggest known,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't the first known.
Oh. Wow. I just think that's nature. That's very interesting. Does it have to do with the Lagrange points as well?
It's something to do with the Lagrange points. You can see the orbits really circling around three of them.
Right, right.
And so this is something that Lagrange never considered, but, you could have, So uh-huh. It's certainly in the same analysis that Lagrange did could have shown the horseshoe orbits could exist.
Right. So would this infer that we need to be even more careful about putting satellites in at Lagrange points, especially around L3?
Well, L3 wouldn't be very useful because it would be behind the sun.
Right. But, I was just bringing up a...
There's no higher density of stuff there.
Mm.
It's just that some of the stuff is actually in a fairly stable orbit. The interesting thing is, even though these objects have orbits that are very close to the Earth's orbit, they're not a hazard because they never get close to the Earth.
Yeah, and they may be a help rather than a hindrance to knock stuff out of the way, too, right? Possibly?
Very unlikely. Space is still very empty.
Ah. I just think it's very interesting, a 350-year orbit, and it's been doing it for a million years.
Well, it's not necessarily a million. They followed it back about 300,000 years, though.
So. Oh, okay.
But it's conceivable that it's in a very stable orbit. They need more observations to be, measure its orbit exactly, and then they can predict again how far back it's been stable.
Huh. Interesting. Well, thank you again so very much for your talk this evening, Dr. Wright. And we want you to remember to tune in for our next teleconference, which will be Thursday, November 17th, with Brian Day on the LADEE mission. And there's a lot of citizen science that you might be interested in doing yourself. As always, if you have any questions or ideas for the Night Sky Network, please let us know. Thanks, everyone, and good evening.
Good evening.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for your participation. This concludes today's call. You may disconnect at this time.